This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 Chai FM.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, somebody we really wanted to talk to for quite a while, actually, Fiona Ramsey, the well-known vocal coach, instructor in drama, and, oh, just by the way, actress. I'm not sure which one I use anymore, with a very long resume of major productions that she has either helped put together or has acted in. And one little bit of history, which I'm not sure even Fiona may remember, because she's a stickler for coaching regional vocal accents. And at one point, I got a call from her and she said, "Help, I have to coach somebody on an actual accent from Cleveland, Ohio." And I said, "Well, I'm not from Cleveland, and I don't really know anybody from Cleveland, but I know exactly where you have to go to hear the precise Cleveland accent." And I said, "You dial up some videos of the Drew Carey Show, because it takes place in Cleveland." And she did, and you got a perfect Cleveland accent. It's different than Chicago. It's different than the Northeast in the United States, and it's demonstrably Clevelandish, I guess. But we're really delighted to have you. And the reason why we're talking to Fiona today is that she is now on stage at the Theater on the Square in Sandton in a play, The Opera Singer, written by, and I'm going to get this name right, I hope. Oh, goodness. Tell me the author's name. I've just drawn a total blank. It's amazing.
Hi, Brooks. It's lovely to be here. It was written and directed by Jana Ramos Violante. And she and I had worked a lot, actually, at the Theatre on the Square before. We did Doubt and we did Miss Dietrich Regrets and we did The Imagined Land in one sort of season. But we've worked very closely together, Jana and I, since we first met. We kind of sparked each other creatively. We collaborate incredibly well together, and we just both love working, and we have a very similar vision of theatre. So she wrote this play. It was a one-woman show initially, and I said to her, having done 12 one-woman shows, I said, "Jana, I really don't want to do another one-woman show. It's a lonely, lonely tour doing a one-woman show." And so she also knew an actor who she'd worked with in Salzburg, and so she wrote a two-hander for us. He is Owain Rhys-Davies, and he lives in London, but he's actually Welsh. So it's an amazing kind of combination of a kind of international collaboration. It was done in Salzburg first. It was actually performed first in Salzburg. It was part of the arts festival in Salzburg. Okay. And it, you know, there's a big opera season around that time. So it tapped into the audiences that were there for kind of opera proper. And they came to see this show, which is not, you know, it's based on an opera singer, but the play is really about life and about legend and about fame and about just getting older and losing your chops. But it's very funny, it's very witty, and it's quite poignant at the same time. So it was done in Salzburg, and then we've just finished a very successful run in Cape Town, and now we're at Theatre on the Square.
It's not based on the life of Maria Callas, but if you close your eyes just a little bit, you can feel the similarities. I mean, there have been several films about Maria Callas, and there's enormous legendary stuff about her, very much on the questions of fame and getting older and losing your first-tier chops as the artist that you were and want to be but are not now anymore. Is it based on her life in some way, or is it based on the circumstances of life like that?
I think it's more circumstances of life like that. It was originally going to be about Maria Callas. Unfortunately, the rights to anything about Maria Callas are astronomically expensive. really, really expensive. And we kind of thought it limited it a bit. It kind of limits the actual discourse in the play because it's an amalgamation of divas. Of course, Maria is the most prominent one. I'm dressed like Maria. I don't talk. I talk with a slightly Italian accent because we don't want to be Greek. So I speak with a slight Italian accent, and she speaks Italian. So it's an amalgamation of opera singers, but Carlos is very much kind of identifiable within it. Although the factually, her mother died after Maria did, and in this version, she dies before. For kind of dramatic narrative. But you could be forgiven for thinking it was Maria, but it is, it's Renata Tebaldi, it's a whole lot of other divas.
Yeah, my wife and I spent some time this morning talking about different opera singers, the cult of the diva, and Maria Callas obviously is the uber example of this, but there's a long list of others who could well have been the same kind of person. Callas, of course, got, I don't want to say lucky, but she got increasing fame not simply by virtue of her performances, but of her life and loves and falling out of love and staying in love and the whole large picture of her as a sort of a world person.
Absolutely. I mean, she was, some people said she was more famous after she stopped singing than during the time that she was singing. Her private life was something of a mystery to people, and they obviously were more interested in that sometimes than her singing, and particularly when her voice started going. And there are so many different stories as to why her voice actually faltered. One of them was that Norma, which she sang a lot, the role is not meant to be sung a lot. It is a very, very demanding role, and most divas sing it about four or five times in their lives. She sang it 79 times.
I think she liked it a lot.
I think so. And I think it was very dramatic, and I think it suited her. But the wear and tear on her voice was that is what an opera aficionado told me. There's another theory that she lost an incredible amount of weight. People say she had a tapeworm or something, but she lost an enormous amount of weight very quickly, which has a disastrous effect on the vocal cords. It just can't adjust in time, it can't recalibrate. And the last one, which I think is probably the most plausible, is that when she had her affair with Aristotle Onassis, he forbade her to sing. He hated her singing, he hated opera. And so she spent a lot of time with him on his yacht, Christina, and she was never allowed to even do scales. So, as we all know, a diva without discipline and without scales and without practice cannot maintain her instrument. So that's quite an interesting take on it. We don't surmise that in the play. That is not touched on at all, the fact that she just did lose her voice.
So there's no tapeworm in the show either.
Hopefully not.
I mean, the tapeworm story I've read so many times in real biographies as well as more scandalous kinds of things that I gather it is real or was real, I guess. And a curious bit, she's actually a New Yorker by birth.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
And
But she had a very complicated relationship with her mother. No, she was from New York, but she spoke Greek at home, so she had this very strange accent, actually slightly American, slightly mid-Atlantic, because she liked to pride herself on a perfect English accent. She, of course, was a polyglot. She spoke Italian, French, Greek, Spanish. She really mastered languages. And so she had this very strange accent. In fact, it's interesting, Brooks, because at the beginning I dabbled with a different accent. And because kind of starting off more American and sliding back into her kind of Greek roots as she kind of got older and as she got more emotional. But a lot of people just thought that I hadn't sustained my accent. So for an accent coach, that's anathema. So the play has been a work in progress. So this version that we did in Cape Town was not the same version that we did in Salzburg. It was rewritten. And this version that we're doing in Johannesburg is not the same that we did in Cape Town. It has been changed slightly. So we keep on making adaptations because it's a brand new play, and you do have to revisit the actual text. And so that's what Jana has done. She has revisited the text a lot and added stuff where she felt that the transitions weren't right. So it's very alive for us because we have to re-rehearse all the time. So it's great for us.
As I understand the mechanism of the play, you have you and your character, and you're being interviewed by a fairly persistent but slightly shy interviewer who is both desperate to get to the truth and in awe of the character at the same time.
Absolutely. And so I think the Jana was interested in the ethics of journalism and what, especially with the advent of, social media, AI, fake news, that what is true and what is not true, and what do you report and what don't you report, and where does intimacy belong? I mean, do you just bare their secrets? A bit like if you think of a modern day diva, like what is her name? The British pop girl that died, Edie. What was her name? Edie. What? Oh, I've forgotten her name. With big, she had a big black hair.
I'm trying to. I know who you
You
mean.
know who I
This
mean?
is a plague. As we get older, Amy
Absolutely.
Winehouse.
Yes, but that's right, Amy Winehouse. And I mean, the intrusion of the press on her life was, it was so damaging. So I think the play not only deals with the life of a diva, but the life of the life that their private lives play, and how they are kind of written about, and how they play out in a public space. So it touches on lots of things. It's a really interesting play for thought. It's thought-provoking.
We're going to take a quick break. We're speaking with, of course, Fiona Ramsey, whose talents exceed normal descriptions, but she's in a new play, or a newish play, at the Theatre on the Square. It's running now. Go see it. And this is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and we'll be back in just a minute.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm speaking, of course, to Fiona Ramsey, actress extraordinaire, playwright, vocal coach, teacher of drama, master of accents. One thing intrigues me now that you describe the nature of the character you're portraying, and that her accent starts American and begins to, as she gets more excited, begins to drift somewhere over the Atlantic and starts to pick up a more Greek style accent. How do you calibrate something like that? If you shift, I know when an actor or an actress picks an accent, they work hard at maintaining that. And then you're describing someone who's sort of cycling through different kinds of vocal circumstances. How do you do that?
So what it happened quite naturally when I was rehearsing, but in fact, I've gone against that now. I don't play that. I'm more consistent with the accent, which the audience finds it easier to relate to her, because the danger of it is that you shift. The shift is so great for the audience to kind of assimilate that it's almost like two different characters. So I've eschewed that, and I now am more consistent with the accent, although she is quite grand at some points, but it's more integrated, and you can't really, it doesn't shift. Although, I would love to have played it like that, but I think it was too confusing for the audience. I think they found it difficult.
I've always had a theory about productions in South Africa. People who are doing a part that is an American character have real trouble in finding that American voice that doesn't sound ridiculously contrived or hyperbolic almost. If they're doing an American voice, they end up with a sort of a fake Southern accent. You all come back real soon now. Yeah, or very Bostonian, hawk the ka in the yod kind of accent. But it's very hard for actors and actresses to find a sort of a standard American accent. And I was really put on notice by that. And when I watched a production you were in years ago, a production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, if you recall, some of the cast seemed to struggle a little bit more with that than you did. And I realized Americans have an enormous difficulty in doing South African style accents, or in most cases, British style accents, and let alone when they try to do Afrikaans language accents. I mean, then it really gets exciting when that happens. They end up sounding like they wandered in from Nazi Germany half the time.
Absolutely.
When you coach accents, how do you do that? How do you tell people, okay, your A's are too harsh, your glottals are too crisp or not crisp enough? What's the mechanics of doing this?
So when I teach an accent, I learned with a really fantastic accent coach. His name is Tim Monach. And Tim and I worked on a film together when he was coaching Charlize to be South African, which was kind of crazy. We got together and we spoke a lot about coaching and that. So I don't use the international phonetic alphabet because it is so archaic. And so many actors don't learn phonetics anymore. It's really been some older schools like RADA does and Lambda. But in South Africa, we have 12 official languages. Learning another international phonetic alphabet is very confusing. So I don't do it although I can. And if people do know it, I will write it in phonetics. But I use what I call Fiona's faux phonetics, because I do it with spellings that come from their own tongue. So, for example, I did a movie called Stunder, and the lead guy was Thomas Jane, the lead actor, and he was American. His sidekick was Dexter Fletcher, who was Cockney, and the other chap who played the Afrikaans was Irish-Scottish. So I had to give them accents that actually sat naturally where they were placed, and very different placement each of them. So the American was far more like that. The American was far more like that because it was further forward. The Cockney was further back in the throat, so he was talking like that a bit. Do you know what I mean? I gave him a South African accent that was further back. And then The Irish guy, I gave him a very rolled R's because, the Scottish and the Irish very often roll their R's. So he was far more Afrikaans with a R sound. And so that's how I teach. I don't really teach a generic accent because we find an accent that we can do that is going to be closer to their natural sounds, because that's the way you get the most authenticity out of the accent. So obviously, if you've got an actor that has to do Southern, you have to teach them how to do Southern, even if it's far away from their natural placement. But interestingly, you mentioned Southern. South Africans, because of the way we speak, we say ah. So we default naturally to Southern ah. We default naturally. We don't go I. Do you know what I mean? So we don't go to standard American or standard English, for that matter. They cut corners and go straight to Cockney or to Estuary or something. And Southern is all South African actors end up speaking Southern. So it's
I was going to say there are about five or six different Southern accents too, which is a problem.
Yes.
There are some that really do sound like what I've briefly done, the y'all come back real soon now.
Yeah.
In which most of the words seem to have vanished. But there are others that do sound almost British.
Yes. And quite genteel. Do you know what I mean? It's quite genteel. And in fact, I was working on a musical that's coming to Johannesburg called Pretty Woman. I did the accents for Pretty Woman. And the lead character, based on Julia Roberts, actually, although she's in LA, She's got a kind of Georgian accent, a slight hint of Georgia. So we try to get that every now and again coming through. It makes her a little rougher, it makes her a little tomboyish. And that was fun, just finding tiny little sounds that could bleed into it. But
Just
well, I love teaching accents. I think it's absolutely marvelous. And honestly, I very often write everything out in phonetics for the actor. And then I say, don't think about it, just read what you see. And it's extraordinary how they end up just reading an accent. And why I do that is because if I look at a word written like electricity, and I'm going to say it in an American accent, I will see it in English and translate it sort of on the move, on the hop. Whereas if I see it as ELECH, if I've got a phonetic spelling, it will be electricity. Do you know what I mean? It'll be slightly different. It'll be a different sound that I'm trying to form my mouth into.
I mean, I've done some reading about Japanese actors who are not English speakers and who were hired to do characters in American movies, and they learned their entire part, which would have been considerable, entirely as a phonetic rendering of the part rather than English words. And as a result, they sound, when you see the film, you go, gosh, I didn't know he spoke English. And in fact, he doesn't, but he's learned, he's reading the phonetic rendering of of all the
And it's
dialogue, which is.
amazing how accurate those phonetic renderings can be, to the sounds. They do sound sometimes a little, what is it, too precious. Some of the sounds are too perfect in a way because all our accents are so sort of mixed. But actually, Amra Faye went to do Amra Faye Wright, who was in Chicago for all those years in London and then on Broadway. And she went to do a version in Japanese. And I was with her here, and she was learning to speak Japanese phonetically as well. She had to do it phonetically because she couldn't learn the language quick enough,
The good news about Japanese, it is utterly phonetic. The
Yes,
character,
of course, yeah.
whatever the character is, it's absolutely pronounced the way it is supposed to be every time.
Yeah.
And there are no things like you have in in English where phonemes become very different regardless of what they look like they're written as. When we're talking about this, I must tell you, your eyes light up, your face gets animated. It's almost as if you see this as the best thing you do, the most interesting thing you do.
I think it's one of the most interesting things I do. I mean, it's sort of related to teaching, I suppose. What is great is you go onto location when you work on films. Do you know what I mean? I was in Kenya last year, and it was absolutely stunning for 3 weeks. And it was absolutely stunning working with Michael Fassbender, teaching him one scene in a South African accent, and then teaching some of the French black actors from mainland France to speak with Central African Republic French accents. And that was fascinating. I mean, it was really just fascinating to do. But you get to go to some exotic places, and you get to work in it, it's a very exciting, but there's so little of it now because the movie industry has kind of collapsed in South Africa, which means that one is not in as much demand as one used to be.
That is a shame. We have to take another station break. This is the Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and I'm really, really pleased to be speaking with Fiona Ramsey, actress, playwright, teacher, accents coach, world traveler, and she is in a newish play. I'm not quite sure how to describe it. It's not an old play, but it's had a run in, as she says, in Salzburg and in Cape Town. In earlier iterations. We'll be right back after these messages.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is the Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and I'm really pleased to be speaking with Fiona Ramsey. Well known, I think, to anybody who's ever been in a theater in this country, or perhaps even seen a fair number of films. But she's much more than that. She's got a whole theory about teaching accents, teaching the language, different language from the one one speaks. so that you can be that person on stage or on screen. And let's go to what you're doing after this. I know you have I'm sure you have a very full calendar, but after the opera singer, what happens to you?
So the opera singer has been invited to Vienna, to the English Festival in Vienna. We don't know when that might happen. But I go down to Cape Town to direct a play on Albie Sachs. So that's what I do first. And that also comes to the Theatre on the Square later this year in May. And then I go to England and I go to London and I play in Blonde Poison for a month in a theatre in London. In Chiswick. I then come back and we take the opera singer to Hilton. And then I go to Cape Town and put Albie Sachs in down there. And in the interim, we want to get the opera singer to London and to New York. So it's lots of different things in the pie. But you know that I'm no longer at WITS. I was with WITS for about 10 years. And I actually graduated with my PhD 2 years ago. So, you know, you can never, you can always teach an old dog new tricks because, you know, most people do it in their 20s or 30s. And I did it much later in life, but it was quite fulfilling and quite interesting. So I write a lot of academic articles based on some of that research, and that's quite interesting. So it's kind of quite a full life of lots of different inputs and things.
Well, the list of productions that you're in or involved in or directing, that would leave me lying on the floor, gasping for breath, exhausted, you know, trying desperately to remember my name. You're busy. You're quite busy. I see in your resume along the way, you've also done, obviously, some Shakespeare and played Lady Macbeth. Is there any thought given to the idea that you will take on the other big role in Macbeth, the gender reverse version of Macbeth?
If someone offered it to me, you know, it's all opportunity. Someone offered it to me, I'd grab it with both hands. I mean, I recently played Julius Caesar in a version of Julius Caesar in Cape Town. And the play started with Queen Elizabeth I. And so I was in full Queen Elizabeth regalia. And then she decides that they act out the tragedy of Julius Caesar in her court. And she said, and who best to play Julius but I? And so she becomes Julius Caesar, first in her own dress, and then she changes. And then she comes back as the ghost of Elizabeth I, replete with white contact lenses in my eyes, which was my sort of... So I have played a male role. And, you know, nowadays, it's so popular now that there's a lot of, you know, gender swapping and gender. But I would definitely, I mean, honestly, it depends what comes up. I'll do anything. I'm a bit of a slattern in that way.
I wasn't going to say that, but you did, so it's okay. This whole business of gender reversal in theater and in the movies, I hesitate to say it got kickstarted with the film Shakespeare in Love, but I mean, it certainly made it more popular. For the two people who have not yet seen that film, it's a young woman infatuated with theater who is desperate to play a role in a Shakespearean drama while Shakespeare is still alive, and he falls in love with her, and he puts her in as a woman, only she is playing a man playing the woman role on stage. Is that clear enough?
Yes. So in her private life, she's a man, but then when she goes on stage, she is a boy playing a woman. Because that's they never had female actors in those days. They just had male actors. So, yeah.
And, of course, in Romeo and Juliet, you have to have a young man playing the role of Juliet if you would have been in Shakespeare's time or Regency England or whatever. But I'm fascinated with the way people keep trying to rearrange classic works to suit the current times, for example.
I think that there's a... Yeah, there's a trend towards making everything relevant. For example, the when we did Julius Caesar, I had a really golden crown with a golden forehead. I mean, the analogy with Trump was vivid. You know, it was never said, but it was very vivid, this striding the world like a colossus. And I think that everybody's seeking to make things sort of to make them relevant and to make them very current and to make them now. I don't think you can do that with all Shakespeare. I don't think it works. But it's an interesting take, you know, it's an interesting take, and it's difficult though to, we did a version of Midsummer Night's Dream, not Midsummer Night, Merchant of Venice. Janice Honeyman directed it, and we set it in, it was at the time of Nazi Germany, and of course the brown shirts, the Mussolini. So we were in Italy, and it was set in that time, and it was very, 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 very gripping and very, you know, obviously anti-Semitism, Shylock. It was riveting. But some people said it lost, you know, it lost something of its bigger context in a way. Do you know what I mean? It tends to focus on one aspect of the play, not in its, although I thought it was very successful.
You know, some people would like a play like that, especially to allow the audience to go, aha, yes, I hear, I feel, I sense the contemporary resonance without necessarily having to have it, you know, smack you in the teeth with it. Mm-hmm. We have to take a quick break, and we are The Deep Dive, of course. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest, Fiona Ramsey. And we'll be right back after these messages.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm speaking, of course, to Fiona Ramsey, actress extraordinaire, playwright, vocal coach, teacher of drama, master of accents. When we were talking about the contemporization of plays like Shakespeare, the one that sticks in my mind most, it was not outrageously successful, but it was astonishingly, it had a great impact. It was a production of Richard III on film that took place in Britain, in an imaginary Britain that obviously had been taken over by Oswald Mosley. And I think it was Ian McKellen who
yes.
was third. And everybody was strutting around in sort of semi-Nazi uniforms. And there was a lot of menace in it. It wasn't, you know, you wondered about the play, whether it fit perfectly. But it, by golly, the impact of it was quite something. So it can work.
Yeah, it captured the sinister nature of just how harrowing and awful that period was. I don't know if you saw recently on one of the late night American channels, Ian McKellen appeared. I forget whose show it was, but he came forward and performed a speech from a very little known work. I think it's in an archive. We don't know what play it belongs to. It was more like a poem, but it is by a king quelling his people who are rising up against immigrants. And he quells them and says, I'm sure you might have seen it. But he then, as he finishes, he says, that was written 460 years ago. And look how relevant it is now. So, you know, that was, it could have been said yesterday. You know, it was, it's really shattering and it's kind of awful, shivering inducing.
No, I did see it. In fact, several people in the U.S. sent it to me to say, have you seen this yet?
Incredible.
Well, three or four times already. Thank you. but I mean, he delivered it in a way which, I'm going to use the word again. He contemporized the quality of the speech in a way that you really could imagine that it was being said last week or last month. Let me cycle back now to the opera singer. You don't sing on stage, do you?
No, but my fellow actor is a Welshman. That should give you an indication. All Welshmen can sing. You know, she doesn't sing. And in fact,
so they say.
When we did it in Salzburg, quite a well-known Austrian opera singer came to see it. And he spoke to me afterwards and he said to me, what an absolutely brilliant touch it was that you'll never, that the diva doesn't sing. I said to him, you don't know how brilliant, you don't know what a brilliant choice it was, because I'm not an opera singer by any means. But I think what it does is it creates a mystery around her, far more than if she did sing. Do you know what I mean? Than if she did than if she did sing. So I don't sing, but as an opera coach who also came to see the show, he said, I believed every moment that she was an opera singer. The way she did, and the way she talks to him, the way she talks about her craft, the way she, he said, every single ounce, he said, I was in tears because it reminded me so much of the people that I have coached in over many, many years. So that was very gratifying, I must say. Nice to know that I got something right.
Well, yeah, no, I've talked to my wife who does sing, or and has in the past, certainly. And one of the things we have noticed is when she comes back from a performance, whether it was in earlier years as a soloist or in choral presentations, there is an enormous amount of adrenaline built up in the body of a singer, much more than, I think, than an actor who does lines but certainly no singing. And her argument is that the actor is working more from the head and the singer is working more from the other part of the body, the heart and the lungs. And so the emotional quality of it, you come off that adrenaline high and everything is brighter and more real. And it's the kind of thing where that person, you should not cross that person with any sort of comment, because they are at a particular point where you're going to get your head snapped off.
And because it leaves you with a sense of a certain vulnerability, despite a euphoria, there is a certain vulnerability at having spent, you know, and given so much. I think it actually depends. As an actor, I like to choose work that challenges me intellectually, emotionally, everything. And I've always said that being on stage as an actor, you feel completely alive, because every single cell is geared towards this performance. And if you are doing a highly charged performance, you can reach a level of singing. You can reach the same sort of engagement where the breath and the, you know, and the emotion and then the voice is, but those are kind of like Medea or, you know, very, 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 very impassioned speeches. You can feel that. But I agree with you. I think singing is an extraordinary talent and an extraordinary gift to have, you know, to be able to sing. I mean, we all sing. I sing all the time, but I'm not so sure it's that melodious. But it does leave you feeling better. You know, you feel better.
Well, I'm in awe of people like yourself who can carry these things off with aplomb, make it natural. I'm one of these people. I was banned from a high school musical, Oklahoma. I had four words, two different interjections in it. And I was supposed to say it before the chorus broke into, everything's up to date in Kansas City. I was supposed to say, yeah, what? And then for verse two, I was supposed to say, what next? Notice my accent. I got them backwards. And I had half the cast engaged with verse two and half the cast engaged with verse one with the stage action. Some of the people were doing the stage action from the second verse and some of them. And I was then fired ignominiously from a high school production.
Yeah, I don't know. Some people say, you know, I still teach quite a lot. I teach privately, and I was teaching at a school this morning, a drama school. And students often say, are there people that can act and people that can't act? And I do tend to, you can learn. I mean, I can teach people how to use their voices. I can teach them how to interpret a text. I can teach them all, give them all the tools, but I can't make them creative. You know what I mean? I can't give them imagination. That I can stimulate it, but I can't give it to them. So I suppose there is a way in which people that have a facility for it can do it. And people that don't have a facility for it, you know, have other talents, you know, a talent that doesn't allow them to, it's not performative. It doesn't translate into performativity. But then, having said that, I think most people can learn to act.
We have to take one last break before the end of our program. This is the Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector of Hi FM. My guest today, Fiona Ramsey. And we'll be right back for a wrap-up. And I have one last question. I'm going to give her like 30 seconds to answer the question. We'll be right back after these messages.